This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. The morning run begins with me, Sharad Kutin, and Uma Paganampika Pakid. And we're going to be with you until 10 o'clock this morning with lots of very interesting information. This, of course, is World Press Freedom Day. Before we get to that, just a quick rundown of the kinds of things that you're going to be listening to this morning. Uma, are you ready for this exciting lineup?
I really am.
There's no irony in that. Okay, we're going to be talking about many things, including Apple's earnings, Temasek and Jack Ma's backed fund invest in genomics business. I mean, these are just some of the business stories. We're also going to be looking at some local political stories, including the newspapers this morning. We have possible scams being talked about on the front pages of our newspapers. We're also going to have, because it's World Press Freedom Day, Breakfast Grill with Yang Berhormat Dato' Noor Jazlan Mohamad. He's the Deputy Minister of Home Affairs. And the questions we're going to be putting to him are, what is the meaning of press freedom in our multiracial and multireligious country? We're also going to be having a discussion on fake news on the current affairs segment. That's after the 8:30 news with Chamil Waria of the Malaysian Press Institute and Zarum Naim at the University of Nottingham, Malaysia. Because fake news is big news these days, isn't it?
Or huge.
It is. And later on, we're going to be going to analysts such as Mohsin Aziz. He's an aviation analyst with Maybank Investment. And also Dodge Dolan, Chief Investment Officer at Land Infused Capital Managers in New York. We also end the day with the BBC and its look at India's cashless economy and what it means for the ordinary Indian. Now, very quickly, we're going to play you a clip from the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, his message on World Press Freedom Day 2017.
Journalists go to the most dangerous places to give voice to the voiceless. Media workers suffer character assassination, sexual assault, detention, injuries, and even death. We need leaders to defend the free media. This is crucial to counter prevailing misinformation, and we need everyone to stand for our right to truth. On World Press Freedom Day, I call for an end to all crackdowns against journalists, because a free press advances peace and justice for all. When we protect journalists, their words and pictures can change our world. Thank you.
That was the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres speaking on World Press Freedom Day 2017, something that was called for by the UN, UNESCO in particular,
yeah,
in 1993. Now we go to Sweet Home Alabama by Lynyrd Skynyrd, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, The Morning Run continues. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Uma Paganampika Pakin. Good morning. And that was Sweet Home Alabama by Lynyrd Skynyrd, a name that only just tips Uma Paganampika Pakin as a difficult name to pronounce early in the morning. I just want to note, Uma, I don't know if you read this, but yesterday, well, actually today, it's American time, Tuesday American time,
yeah.
14 million people around the world are going to be waiting for something to happen on Tuesday American time, because they've all become applicants in something called the Diversity Visa Lottery. And we've heard about this over the years. Apparently, this could be the last year that this lottery is, is had.
Correct. So the Diversity Lottery, or the Green Card Lottery, if you will, I think 50,000 people get selected to get green cards, which is essentially your PR for the U.S., right? It's a lottery. But Trump, for the longest time, has been promoting this merit-based immigration system. So they're saying this might be the last one.
Right. So that's interesting for two reasons. One is the objectives of the diversity is in the name. It's about diversity,
correct,
right? It's getting
randomly selected.
So they're about 1% of the amount of people who actually apply. And because they're randomly selected, you have this diversity from all parts of the world, you know, from, I think, Madagascar to the Ukraine, whatever, Russia included.
I've always liked this idea because only because it falls in line with that idealized philosophy of what America is. Give me your huddled masses, etc., etc.
Absolutely. It's deeply, I mean, I think it's such a wonderful way of branding your country. You're open to everybody. You really want to embrace the world. Isn't that a wonderful message to give the world?
Also, it takes a certain amount of cockiness on America's part, right? You all want to come here.
Hey, but they've got the numbers to prove it. 14 million people around the world apply.
Trump's only been in power for 100 days. That might change.
Yeah, actually, you know, we have some numbers on the Trump effect on brand America, including the dropping rate of Indian nationals going to America. It might also be because of the gun violence, and recently they've been targeted. So that may be a reason for those dropping numbers too.
That, and also they've made active efforts to investigate their visas in Silicon Valley, right? Immigration ICE officers have gone in and they've actually started investigating Indian immigrants, or I say immigrants, I mean these people are on expert professional visas and they're working in places like, you know, like Google and the Apples of the world. And so they are, I think they feel like they're being persecuted, even though they're bringing an incredibly important skill set to America.
Yeah, but you know, I think groups like Infosys have already promised to hire Americans, local Americans, whether they're South Asian Americans. I think the important thing is that they are American citizens in this. I do think, though, you know, coming back to the question of Trump's wanting to turn this into a concerted, a coherent, an absorption of the world's talent, right? So you think of Singapore. Singapore has a foreign talent type policy, meaning they're looking actively around the world for the kinds of people they want to populate their country. Australia has it too, right? Some years, you know, you might be a hairdresser, or hairdressing might be top of the list. But the point is, all of that's it's about targeting your immigration policy, or having your immigration policy really targeted.
And that's exactly what they did with this thing called the H-1B visa, right? Which is the genius visa that America has. I mean, they call it the genius visa, but essentially that's what it is. It's to bring in the best and the brightest, throw them into America, give them a ton of money, and let them do magic and win Nobel Prizes.
Okay, so the thing is, it's not an either-or situation, isn't it? I mean, you could possibly have these two things running concurrently, one targeting, you know, talented people, the other just being about believing in the magic of diversity. And so, because the numbers are quite small, if you think of a country of over 300 million, what is 50,000 adding to the population?
And of course, the randomness of that 50,000, I think, is important. You know, you don't know where your next genius is going to come from. It could be a refugee from Syria. It could be another Steve Jobs from there. I think there is something to be said about getting those people into an environment like like America and seeing what they can do. Right?
What about Malaysia? Do you think we could do something like this? Would you think that Malaysians would support a diversity lottery? And do you think they will come? If we had the lottery, would they say yes? Because, no, we have peace. We're a relatively peaceful country. Crime is reasonably low. You can make a decent living. I mean, ringgit's not so strong today. But, you know, nobody expects it to really go down the dumps too soon.
We're really weird when it comes to things like this, if only because we've accepted our own diversity, but now we seem relatively closed off to the other. So we're okay with the Melayu, Cina, Indian, and lain-lain. But then, if someone comes in from Africa, we're like, oh, no. They're an immigrant.
Or even if you look at conflicts in, say, Bukit Bintang between the old population and the newly emergent Arab community there, right? So always a bit of conflict. Yeah, the new migrants always looked upon suspiciously until they become, well, kind of part of the game.
TN50, Shira, TN50. I think that's the way forward.
Okay, we'll be back. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutan. This is The Morning Run, and that was Sweet Soul Music by Sam and Dave. With me, Uma Paganampike Pakin, and we're going to be talking about runaway maids.
That's right. So this was a report that came out yesterday in The Star. Apparently, one out of 20 domestic workers runs away.
That's 5%.
Yeah, and they give very good reasons for it, right? Among the reasons, you know, abusive employers, you've got getting misled by agencies on job descriptions, and also, you know, better opportunities elsewhere. It's kind of a two-way street. Sometimes the domestic help gets, for lack of a better word, screwed over by the people who are bringing them in. And then sometimes they use that as a kind of stepping stone, if you will, to look for better opportunities while they're here.
Yeah, one of the problems I think that's, that accompanies this phenomenon is that employers tend to hold on to the passports of their employees, which I believe is in fact illegal.
It is.
But they do it, and their excuse always is, that's the only way I can make that person or hold that person to their job. And so, you know, there's a deep moral hazards, I think, involved in all kinds of dimensions of the maid business, but this is one of them.
Yeah, it's not just holding on to the passports. They do a lot of other stuff as well. I mean, you know, they charge them a certain fee. They start deducting it from their salaries. So, you know, their take-home salaries are nowhere near as what was promised because they say, well, you know, you got to pay back all the hard work and money I've spent bringing you here. And then, of course, there's that huge issue of employer abuse. We hear so many stories of it, and some of it has gone to court. Some employers have been charged. I'm always very thankful when that happens. But I can never understand why there's such a high incidence in Malaysia. You know, it's Malaysia and Saudi Arabia. We always hear stories of...
Well, Singapore too. And I think it's the way we kind of view other people, and especially people that who work for us, but who are in some ways, kind of captive situation, right? So the live-in maid, you know, is a particular phenomenon that just is ripe for abuse. And you see it in, you know, and you hear stories all the time of maids who've been in the country for many years and never see the city. I mean, they're just trapped in these homes.
Yeah.
They don't have a social life. They're not allowed to have a social life. And the excuse that that employers give themselves is that, oh, they will go out, they will socialize, they will, you know, find men. I mean, apparently...
And then run away.
Apparently, they're not allowed to fall in love. You know, God forbid that, you know, our employers say that to us. You know, like you work for BFM, but don't you dare fall in love while
like
you work here.
It's like all of the worst parts of 1984.
Yeah. And I think the thing is, it really diminishes us as people, but it's very hard to argue against. Because I've met some really reasonable middle class Malaysians who are in the situation, and they never, you can't talk them through the moral hazard issue.
All right. Well, you know what? Yesterday on the Evening Edition, we caught up with Angel Fernandez from Tenaga Nita, and we asked Angel what happens to domestic workers after they run away from their employers' homes. Here's what she had to say.
From our experience, all these years of working with domestic workers, they really have very little option. When they leave their employer's home because of the conditions that they undergo there, now what they do is they would sometimes ask for strangers' help. And that's how sometimes it is Malaysians who call us and then the domestic worker comes to us. Now, two is they sometimes have friends. They would then call the friends, you know, go with them. Sometimes they go to the embassy. In terms of calling back their family, the family will contact an NGO, and they will, then NGO would contact us, and then we come in to manage the case.
Right. We also spoke to her about the circumstances in which some of these domestic workers come into the country. They can be a little dodgy. And we asked Angel how we can actually make this whole process a little more transparent.
We do not have a proper system in place. We don't have a proper system in place to manage all migrant workers who come to work in the country. And the worst off sector would be the domestic workers, because they don't even have a legislation to protect them in place. And you need to get stakeholders to come together. We have had lots of meetings. I think at the end of the day, it's the political will whether you want to put a proper system in place or you want to have this so-called dodgy way of recruitment, because you are going now from country to country to look for domestic workers. Why we are having this lack of domestic workers is because we are recognized as one of the worst countries of how we treat migrant workers. And that's a fact. And therefore, if we treat migrant workers, including domestic workers, in a proper manner with proper measures in place, then we would have 50% at least of all these problems and issues would be rid of. We have laws, but it's because we do not enforce. And as Malaysians, we always tend to point the finger at who? The victim, and not at the perpetrator. And that's our greatest fault.
Yeah, Angel Fernandez of Tenaga Nita. It's a great point. We victim blame like nobody's business.
And, you know, it is, in fact, the educated middle classes that are largely involved in this particular problem, right? And so we have all the cultural resources. And what is it that we lack? We lack empathy, do you think?
There is a deep-seated problem in the way we view those who come from these countries to work in our homes. Do you not think, Sharad? I mean, like, even
absolutely,
in everyday conversation, we don't see them as people. I mean, we talk to them as if they're lesser than us.
And I think, you know, for those Malaysians, middle-class Malaysians who go overseas, who've experienced what it is to be treated as the outsider, the other, maybe when they come back, they can talk about that, those experiences too. And maybe we can somehow find a sweet spot so we can, you know, find that empathy that clearly is lacking in the way we approach people.
Let me tell you, one of my greatest excitements in life, Sharad, was when I first went to the UK and you see white people taking out the garbage. And you're just like, ha-ha!
Oh, is it sort of suddenly colonialism just evaporated as a problem? Is
exactly.
It like,
I'm like, take that.
Oh, dear, dear, dear. Uma. Dear Uma. Anyway, we're going to be coming up to the news at the bottom of the hour. But before that, we have Oye Como Va with Santana, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, welcome to The Morning Run. I'm Sharad Kutan. With me, Uma Pagan Ambike Pakin.
Hello.
Hello. The morning starts excitedly. I'm actually very excited by today because in some ways it's a day that we can focus on the thing that we do, Uma, you and I. We're in the media and it's World Press Freedom Day today. Certainly is.
It's ironic, I guess.
It's aspirational. I think, you know, when you look at what the whole day is meant to do, in fact, you know, the UNESCO, when it declared in 1993, it said, we are called to celebrate the fundamental principles of press freedom, to evaluate press freedom around the world, to defend the media from attacks on their independence, and to pay tribute to journalists who have lost their lives in the exercise of their profession. In fact, I just did a quick search of how many journalists were killed
In 2016,
some 74 journalists, down from 110 journalists killed the year before, but still 74 too many, I think.
It is. And also, let's be fair, just a few days ago, yet again, the best and worst jobs of 2017 list was released, and reporter, DJ, broadcaster was on the list of worst jobs for 2017.
Really?
Yes. It's like, I think, second or third year in a row, right? And, you know, for reporters and news people, it's that apart from, you know, low salary and pay, it's also the danger that comes with it, especially right. In certain parts of the world, right?
But, you know, it's also true that in especially the developing world, journalists can become heroes. Developing world and the aspiring part of the world, because journalists are there, kind of folk heroes. Haven't they become the kind of modern day folk heroes as well, striving for truth and that kind of mantra? You kind of associate them with that. Potentially?
It does, but I think what's interesting right now is, you know, we talk a lot about post-truth and fake news era and all of that stuff, but I think one of the bigger problems that journalism is facing, apart from monetizing their craft and getting actually paid a good wage and trying to keep it sustainable, is the conflict between corporate interests and commercial interests and good old school, wholesome journalism, right? I think that's something that everyone is finding it incredibly difficult to navigate.
Yeah. But, you know, the world would not be half as interesting if it wasn't difficult to navigate. I think journalists like the challenge. That's why journalists get sucked into war situations. You know, the number of journalists who sign up to go and cover wars because it is exciting, it's difficult, it's challenging,
yeah.
And it keeps you, makes you feel alive, I think.
Did you catch the White House Correspondents' Dinner speech? Did you see any clips from that?
The comedy bit.
The comedy bit. Every year, you know, the White House has a Correspondents' Dinner where they throw a big party for the White House correspondents, the journalists who are kind of assigned to cover the political beat of the White House. This year, for the first time, I think, in decades, the president, his entire administration and staff was not there at the dinner.
Yeah, it's a sign of the times. But, you know, think of the great comedy that was produced by Donald Trump's boycott of the correspondents' dinner.
It was. But the message that came across, whether it's from the serious speeches or even from Hasan Minhaj's little 20-minute comedy routine, was that, hey, you guys have to do your jobs better than ever before. And you have to be beyond reproach because one small mistake is all it takes for Donald Trump to tar everyone with the same brush. And of course, he made the joke saying, now you know what it feels like to be a minority.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a great joke and it was well-timed. And it does underscore the fact that America is losing. I mean, we talk about brand America is no longer there as a shining beacon of democracy, at least not from its political leadership, not
no.
The top of the pinnacle there. I did want to talk about very briefly a piece of news that's kind of like will warm the cockles of your heart. Mm-hmm. If you know, neither of us have children, but if we did, two young Malaysians, Najmi Ashraf Halim and Jad Haris Shabuddin, that 10 and 12 respectively, have won prizes in the 14th World Mathematics Competition in Manila.
Yes.
It happened over the weekend.
That's right.
I mean, who would have thought? I mean, we score so badly on those PISA rankings, the Program for International Student Assessment rankings. We've never done very well on them. And they, you know, they score things like math and reading and science. But these two young kids did very well, partly, I think, because their parents send them to some sort of Japanese, you know, math studying thing, Sakamoto method.
Yeah. I don't know what the Sakamoto method is, but, you know, while I agree, I think as a whole, we should probably do a lot to raise our overall base level of mathematics in the country. I still think it's something very important. But that being said, when people win prizes like this, oh, it's purely due to the parents and the training they get at home.
And not the schools. Did you love maths growing up?
I loved maths growing up, but I didn't have crazy parents that kind of made me be competitive about it. There's a fantastic movie, Sharad, called Spellbound.
Yeah,
about the spelling bee.
Yes.
And, you know, there are all these South Asian American parents forcing their children to memorize the dictionaries so they can win the spelling bee. In many ways, to win these kind of awards, that is the kind of process you need to go through.
Okay.
But it's a highly competitive environment.
Uma, I never really liked math. My mother loved math. My brother was very good at it. And it took me kind of past O levels to really love math and to find some joy in it. And I wish, you know, we did more to make math fun for kids. And I think, you know, kids would get so much of it because it's a wonderful mental exercise. It's like gymnastics for the brain.
It is. And, you know, you're right. The teaching of math could... Yeah, you could do a lot to improve the teaching of math in schools. Algebra and calculus are actually very exciting subjects if you teach it properly.
Calculus was exciting?
Yeah, okay. But you know, we just teach people the symbols for differentiation and we expect people to memorize stuff. Makes it kind of boring.
It does make it kind of boring. But there's nothing boring on BFM or The Morning Run. We'll be back with more after this. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, The Morning Run continues. I'm Sharad Kutin, and with me, Tan Chung Han, just joined us in the studio. And of course, Uma has been here. Uma Pagan Ambik Paken has been here since 6 o'clock. And we're going to be looking at some of the stories, Han, that you're going to be covering later on in the morning, all the business stories. What did we have top of our agenda?
All right, well, we got to look at Apple here because overnight, Malaysian time, they just announced their most recent earnings. And I guess I'll just let it cat out of the bag. iPhone sales actually came below estimates in the first quarter of 2016. Revenue and all hands are falling, also below estimates. But you've got this silver lining in the sense that, you know, like, Tim Cook, Apple CEO, is, you know, expecting there to be a super cycle towards the end of the year. And so essentially, you know, that there are consumers around the world who are perhaps delaying those iPhone purchases in anticipation of what's to come, that being the highly anticipated iPhone 8. Are you a Apple fan there?
I am. Yeah. But it's the 10th anniversary iPhone,
right?
Which they're all expecting to be something special.
And you have doubts because I can see it in your face and I can hear it in the tone of your voice.
No. Not to say I have doubts. I'm being cautiously optimistic. I think everyone has kind of upped their game in regards to competing with Apple. The new Samsung S8 was just released and it's a beautiful looking phone. Huawei has a new phone out. I mean, the China-Taiwan companies are really giving Apple a run for its money with regards to design. So if they want to stay at the top of the pack, they really need to update game.
Right, hence it's this delayed purchasing behavior that Tim Cook attributes or points the finger to in terms of the culprit for those lackluster iPhone sales in the first quarter. But, you know, they're saying, well, at least Wall Street, they are kind of looking at one key statistic, that being 300 million iPhones are set to be upgraded by this fall. Now, that's according to a venture capitalist, Gene Munster. So we'll wait and see, you know, if that actually translates into an earnings bonanza for Apple.
What about the story from coming from down south? Temasek and Jack Ma have apparently come together in some sort of venture.
All right, so I'll give you some brief details on this deal before we go into why this is crucial here. Okay, so real quick, you've got Yanfeng Capital. That's a fund backed by Jack Ma, the Chinese billionaire of Alibaba fame, and they've got Temasek, right? Singapore's state-owned investment company. Now, both of them have co-led a $75 million round of financing into a company called Wuxi Nextcode. This company is, you know, they are in the field of precision medicine. So essentially, they're trying to give genetic tests that can, you know, give you more details about your genetic conditions, etc. Now, this is key because essentially what we're seeing, this is the latest development in this overall push by Singapore and its various entities towards finding these new drivers of growth. If you look at over the last couple of years, you know, Singapore narrowly avoided technical recessions, you know, a couple of times there, and due to the lackluster global demand, you know, so now you're seeing them start up this innovation fund, and you know, they're trying to find new ways, you know, to get returns, not just for Temasek, but for the Singapore economy as a whole. I mean, real quick, Temasek alone, last year they had their worst return since 2009. So for Temasek, they got to turn things around, be, you know, these kind of new innovative, you know, ventures.
Okay, so they'll find a tool to maybe locate genius? Do you think that will go there? I'm kind of looking forward to that.
I think it's important to point out, in the field of genomics, which is this, and also stem cells, Singapore has some of the largest outside investment because of the controversy and moral issues that often come up in America and Europe. Singapore is like a blank slate, so they're just like, come! Give us your money.
They're more than a blank slate. You know, in the 70s, they used to have a eugenics department.
They did.
They were unabashedly pro-eugenics and, you know,
graduates must only procreate with graduates.
And re-engineering the society. Yes, there was the people's sense controversy and there was some pushback from society, but the government is largely insulated from those pressures.
My question here is, Sharad, were you a part of that program?
No, I was never. I was not a test tube baby. No, I wasn't picked for my genius. And that's why I live in Malaysia. Also in the news, Japan's pension fund. Isn't there a pension fund story you're going to cover very briefly?
All right, yeah. So, you know, real quick, this is interesting because it echoes what Malaysia's pension fund or the EPF is doing as well. So essentially, you know, trying to gain more exposure into the real estate sector. You know, if you look at EPF, they've made forays into projects in Melbourne with OSK, even here in Sungai Ijok. You know, so essentially, real estate seems to be the name of the game for these pension funds in terms of ensuring those dividends and those long-term returns for members such as you and I.
Okay, we're coming up to the news at the top of the hour. But before that, we have Finley Key with Your Love Gets Sweeter.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.